This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for April 14th, 2020. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. My name is Drew Messenger-Michaels, and I'm very glad you're here. Today I'm talking to Olaf Carlson of Retroid Games about Wunderling, that studio's rather delightful auto-runner puzzle platformer thing, a game that had completely flown under my radar until I saw it and met Olaf at PAX East in a rather recent and yet quite different and in some ways more innocent historical period. Toward the end, Olaf gets into some of the nitty-gritty of the movement code in the game. We talk a fair bit about its level design and overall intent. I hope you enjoy the talk. So, you know, go ahead. Start enjoying it.
Yes, and I'll do the same then.
Lovely. All right, let me know when you're ready.
I guess I'm ready.
Okay, that works out then.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, like I said, thanks for being here, and we'll start in the simplest place possible and then sort of branch out from there. For anybody who doesn't know, what is Wunderling?
Wunderling is a game, it's a puzzle platform game, where we basically take the basic platformer premise of you playing as the hero and trying to save, like, the princess, and we turn it on its head. So instead, you are playing like the low-level video game enemy, like the one that just walks back and forth. So you've been sent by the boss of the game to chase down the hero, basically. So it's kind of, I say puzzle platformer, because it becomes more about figuring out how to get where you want to go. So you see the goalpost, and the only way for you to change direction is to hit a wall. So you need to like plan out your route and figure out like, oh, if I jump there, I can turn over there and I can get back to this place. So it's a fun like twist on the genre, I'd say.
Yeah, definitely. It's an auto runner fundamentally, right? It plays a little bit like the mobile Rayman games or something, but there's a justification for why you can't decide when you turn, why you can only turn when you hit a wall, and that's that you're sort of a Goomba-ish thing. You initially sort of look like a cross between the Illumination animation minions and a Goomba and a potato, sort of. So it's like an inherent property of who you are that you don't have complete control, and the game sort of rolls out abilities that are familiar to you in platformers slowly throughout the game, but it is very much like a game based around limitation. Is that a fair thing to say?
Absolutely. That's a very good description. And that's actually something that was very important to us early on in the process. Because this game actually started as sort of a remake of an old mobile game that the company I worked for did before, called Cow Dash. So In the game, there is a cow called Dash, which was the playable character of that game.
Deep cut for the fans, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that game was like pretty much the basic premise, but because it was a mobile game, so that's kind of how they wanted it to play. And when we wanted to make like this reimagining of it, we were thinking, how can we figure out a real good reason for why you are playing the game as you are playing it? And we had like a 30 minutes or so where we talked about it, and we kind of sort of quickly figured out, oh wait, you can just play the, like, which character usually does this? Oh, it's the little Goomba guys. You can just play that, and everything sort of like fell into place.
Completely. I mean, it's one game among many, I should say, that uses the fact that we all understand the language of Mario to sort of branch out from there, right? But it also, I think, does kind of a fun job of foregrounding how weird it is that we all understand the language of Mario, that jumping on things' heads and weird anthropomorphic, you know, foodstuffs and whatever, you know, plants. Like, the fact that that's all in our DNA as people who play video games is itself strange, and the game kind of messes around with that. But it also, it's totally clear. If you see a thing that looks like a Goomba and it can only sort of go left and right, that makes sense instantly.
Yeah.
And that's, odd though it may be that it does.
It's fun to be able to, like, stand on the shoulders of giants, I would say then. Well, that's also a very fun point, because as you said, when you play it, it immediately makes sense. But we've experienced, we showed the game at many conventions. The first time we showed a game was 2 months after we started working on it, actually, at the PAX East 2017. And what we notice is that people don't at all realize that it's an autorunner until they start playing it. They all just assume that everyone is very bad at the game and just keeps on walking into spikes, walking off of ledges. But as soon as they get their hand on their controller, it makes sense. So that's been fun.
That's interesting, yeah. Yeah, because it is sort of a one-handed game. It's not a one-button game, at least not the whole way through. But it is a game that you can sort of just like, you know, keep a, you know, thumb and forefinger ready to go. And it's pretty neat in that sense. But you're right, if you're watching someone play it, it could just look like they're playing a regular platformer badly.
Yes, exactly. It's funny you said that about one-hand game. That's it's true, and I think it's a fun like feature to talk about. And I remember an anecdote from, I think, early on in development. We were talking about the fact that you can play it one-handed, and I accidentally said, yeah, so you can do something fun while you're playing it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it's not a one-handed game in the sense of certain... There are genres that are one-handed games in a very different sense.
Yes,
or one-handed reads or what have you. No, this is not that. I mean, you know, people are into what they're into. No judgment. But it's not designed that way, certainly. And it's like the... It's good in a bunch of ways because it simplifies the controls, obviously, you know, especially someone who's not that familiar with games. If you hand them a controller and there's just that many buttons, it's a classic problem that they can be overwhelmed. This sort of limits that problem.
Yes.
It's also great from an accessibility perspective. My niece really only has use of one hand when she plays games. So when something comes along that she can legitimately play the whole way through with one hand, that's huge for her, you know?
Oh,
and
awesome.
I don't get the sense that you built it with that in mind, but it's just sort of an interesting knock-on effect of simplicity.
Exactly. We didn't actually plan for it, but yeah, it's been very fun too. Because, you know, games these days, I think, are thinking more about accessibility than they've ever done. But there's still way more that can be done. So it's been, I guess, we've been lucky to just accidentally want to make a game that's just in its nature accessible.
Do you, when you've seen people play it, especially at conferences, do you see a difference in how, you know, people who are very experienced with games play it versus people who are not? I mean, as you say, if you're watching it, you may just not understand what the game is because you might think someone is controlling, you know, the movement with the left stick or something like that. But once someone sits down, do people who are, you know, are steeped in Mario or what have you have a different experience with it than people who are maybe new to this kind of game?
I would say so, yes. It's been very varied, the reaction, I guess, but I think very commonly, if someone is like they play a lot of platform games, and they just assume that they would understand immediately how it works. So it's usually for those people, it's been like it's a slow process of them being like, oh, wait, I can let go of the stick, and it doesn't. Oh, wait. It's like slowly breaking them down. What I would find, like, people that don't play games a lot, I think they are quicker to get into it because they don't have any like predetermined judgment of how it should be. So that's
interesting. Yeah. That's interesting. But I spoke to William Cheer a little while ago, who made Manifold Garden, and he said something really similar. I don't know if you've played that game, but basically the world wraps around, right? So there's lots of traversal points where you have to sort of jump off a ledge, and then you just keep falling, getting a little closer to the ledge on the opposite side. I'm describing it badly, but basically when you fall, you don't die. You just keep falling, and there's always a world beneath you. So he was saying that people who play a lot of games very carefully walk the paths and try not to fall, and therefore have a much harder time solving the puzzles than people who don't play games that well and just fall off by accident and realize it's not going to hurt them. You know, there's a certain freedom to not coming with those expectations, and yet those expectations are sort of exactly what makes the game legible and funny in the case of Wonderling, you know. So it's like an interesting balance.
Very much so.
So it's very at home on the Switch. Your studio, Retroid, correct me if I'm wrong, your last sort of big release was Picto Party for the Wii U.
Correct, yes.
Yeah, so it seems to me you're sort of ensconced in the Nintendo aesthetic to a certain degree, but also more than that, interested in reaching, in making games that can reach people who are not necessarily the hardest of the hardcore capital G gamers or whatever. Picto Party was definitely in that lane. Wonderling is more than it appears to be once you start actually playing it. Is that sort of just a desire to reach a large audience, or is there something, you know, sort of more specific in the intent there?
It's a good question. I'm not sure, actually. To me, to me, it's more like these are the games that we want to make, and they just happen to fit in these kind of, like, sure, Picto Party was very much like, so I wasn't part of the team when that game was initially developed, but I did do the Chromecast version. And
oh, cool.
So to me, it's actually, it's like, oh, this is a game that we know the concept works really, really well. Like, it's a classic. It's basically Pictionary. You know what it is.
Right.
So how can we just take advantage of the hardware and make something, like, make this accessible, I guess. So, yeah, when I say that out loud, I guess yes.
Sure. Yeah, you know, but that's interesting, right? Like, it's not, there's nothing cynical about it. It's not like, well, you know, well, filthy casuals like this and this and that, right?
No, exactly. But,
so therefore, we'll make that. It's just like you said, these are the games you're interested in making.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, Picto Party came out in 2015, I believe, right? So it was right around the time that the Jackbox party packs started coming out, right? Which are sort of similarly, I mean, there's a drawing game in almost all of them, for one thing. But also on a broader level, they're just very interested in that sort of like pick up and play. Even if you don't play games, you can, you know, be involved in the party kind of thing, right? So it's like, Picto Party feels to me like something hitting that same kind of zeitgeist.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
I think that's funny. Very much like a, like, things that are similar seem to come out at around the same time, which is weird. I will always think of the old example of Infamous and Parasite, two, like, super villain games, I guess. Games take a long time to develop, so.
So it cannot be that one was influenced by or stealing from the other. There
exactly.
has to be something else going on. Yeah.
I think that's very interesting. If I was still in academics, I would totally do like a dissertation of that, I think.
I mean, this is a well-observed phenomenon in the sciences even, right? Like the whole simultaneity thing where two people can be working toward the same theory or very similar theories at the same time with no knowledge of each other's work. You know, that's just because they're influenced by the same historical forces or something, you know?
Oh, I didn't know there was a word for that. That's awesome. I need to check that out.
I'll put a link in the show notes. But it's a really interesting phenomenon because, you know, after all, we all live in the same world. We're influenced by some but not all of the same stuff. I think that happens in game design a lot. There's just something in the water. In the case of the Wii U and of smartphones, right, it's also just people reacting to the fundamental nature of the device. The fact that you have a touchscreen and maybe a stylus. In the case of the Wii U, it lends itself to drawing, right? Like, regardless of what lane you take with that.
Yep. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, similarly, I think the Switch, to kind of bring it back to Wonderling, very much promotes, how to say it, very large experiences broken up into bite-sized pieces. Mm. Wonderling is very much like that. It's a lot of levels, but each one is pretty short, and especially as you start getting further in, there are checkpoints and all that. So it's easy to play on a commute or something like that.
Yeah.
But then, you know, that same concept applies even to something like Breath of the Wild, right? Like it's this giant epic open world game, but it's very much designed so that you can, or maybe they stumbled upon this accidentally because it wasn't originally a Switch game. I think they've actually maybe said that was the case. You can do one thing and then put your Switch away, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, I think people's relationships to games have maybe changed a bit because of the Switch. I don't know if you feel the same.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It's made like, I don't know what the right word is, like mainstream gaming, like big console gaming has been so much more accessible now because you can basically take it anywhere. And it's insane the kinds of games that have actually ported to it, which, like, to me, even though I know that I'll have a better experience playing something like The Witcher on my PS4, I probably prefer it on the Switch because that, thanks to the Switch, I can actually break it up into those small bite-sized pieces. I can just play it between, as you said, on the commute or whatever.
At this, we should say that the exact historical moment we're speaking on April the 3rd, 2020. So nobody's commuting right now, or very few people are.
True.
But in general, yes, very good point. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people who I would never in a million years have said, you really need to play Divinity Original Sin 2 or Final Fantasy 9, even though I knew they would enjoy it, because I knew for a fact they were never going to sit down with their computer for 50 or 100 hours and play them. But they're absolutely going to play them 45 minutes, you know, at a time on the train, you know?
That's a perfect example, actually. I just bought that game a couple months ago, and I put like 20 hours into it on the Switch, because I would never have played it otherwise.
Divinity Original Sin we're talking about, or Final Fantasy?
Divinity Original Sin 2.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's really good, isn't it? I missed it on the PC, and I've been playing it on Switch as well, and I love it.
It is. It's been really fun. But that's actually what you said about the current climate. So I've been actually playing my PS4 more now, because I'm basically stuck at home with my big screen TV. And I have time to dig down, and I can like appreciate those experiences. But I still find myself taking out my Switch every now and then, because it's just easier to like literally pick up and play.
Absolutely. With Animal Crossing out, I think a lot of people just sort of have their Switches on ambiently. I mean, I've worked from home for a while, so I'll sort of just, you know, if I'm working into the evening, I'll also be sitting in my hammock in Animal Crossing and watching for shooting stars or something, right? Mm-hmm. I think this is a moment where people are engaging with games in a bunch of different ways. But what you just said is really interesting, which is that people are maybe... like, the Switch is good for a distracted world where people, you know, only have little nuggets of time to interact with games. This moment we're in is actually great. Like, it's a great time to pick up Bloodborne or something, right?
Yeah.
Something that requires a lot of sustained attention and would benefit from a big screen TV. I don't have any hard data on whether people are doing that more. I've certainly found myself doing it a little bit. I booted up the Monster Hunter update and all that.
Nice.
But yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting that your PS4 is getting more love in these strange times we live in.
Yeah, like the last time I played my PS4 a lot, I was in uni, and I would say I had a lot of time. I spent a lot of time playing games. I didn't spend as much time studying as I should have. And as soon as
sure.
I started working...
It's a common situation, I think, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And as soon as I started working, like, as you said, you get more... You have more distractions, you have less free time, and then, like, the Switch was more accessible, I guess. Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if that... I want to see the data points on this, like, later on.
Yeah, yeah. It's probably really hard to compare. It's total apples and oranges, because there isn't like a shared data set anywhere. But this, I mean, the people's relationships to games and the amount and the kind of attention they give them is very interesting to me. And it seems like Wonderling is pretty thoughtful about that, right? Because obviously traversal is simple in some ways, complicated in others. Like, one thing we haven't said about it yet is it is somewhat hard. It's really only... very hard if you're trying to, you know, 100% it, get all the collectibles. The harder paths tend to be the ones with the treasure chests and things like that. It's not too bad if you're just trying to get through the levels and breezing through. And in fact, if you're doing that, it's a little bit less of a puzzle game, more of just a platformer. But for someone who's not that familiar with platformers, I'm sure it could still seem steep, right? So it is a little bit... It's not white knuckle, but like I said, it reminds me of the new Rayman games, and not just in the sense that it plays a bit like the mobile ones, but also in the sense that the levels have like a rhythm to them. You know what I mean? There's a real sense in which you've gone on a little journey or heard like a little movement of music or something when you go through one of these levels. They're pretty well designed. So they're like very much designed, it seems to me, for switchy kind of play, for lack of a better term, where you're very, very sucked in for a very brief period of time. And then you can either say, hit me again, or you can move on.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. That's how my girlfriend plays the game. She doesn't really play a lot of games, but she bought Wonderling because she, like, I guess, want to support me. That's fine. Ah. So she picks it up and goes to 100% like one or two levels, and then she like basically throws down the Switch in frustration. like, she's made progress, but as you said, like, if you want to get everything, the game can be very, very difficult. But we really tried our hardest to design around that, to make that easy for you to, like, we spent a lot of time working on making sure that restarting was quick, just like basically tweaking levels so that the challenge isn't in, oh, I know what I want to do, but I just the game didn't let me do it. Instead, it was always, we wanted to make it so that you always feel like it's my fault that I didn't make that jump. And it doesn't matter, right? Because I can just restart and I can get back there in like 10 seconds.
Yeah, yeah. One of the sets of influences we haven't talked about yet is a genre that doesn't totally have a name. I usually call it Zen Massacre, right? Massacre referring to really hard platformers. Mm-hmm. Zen Massacre referring to the subgenre of those that are sort of designed not to be too frustrating. Sort of beginning with Super Meat Boy, I always think of VVV, VVV. Celeste is a recent really, really good example. But yes, games that are really hard and really demanding, but are sort of designed from the ground up not to, because like classic Massacre games like I Want to Be the Guy are in a very real sense trying to fuck with you, right? Yeah, like they're exactly trying to be frustrating. They're trying to frustrate whatever path you thought was the correct path is the incorrect path, and in fact something dumb will fall on you and kill you. Wonderling, it belongs more to the Super Meat Boy lane, or I think more properly the Celeste lane, the sort of refined version of that idea.
Yes.
Where yeah, resets are really quick, level, you know, challenges are bite-sized. It also does something really interesting, Wonderling does, that So like I usually play games the way you're describing your girlfriend playing Wonderling. I 100% a level before moving on. Even if I go back and play Mario 64 or something, I'll like get all the stars in a you know, in a world before moving on if I can, or something like that. With Wonderling, I haven't been, because there's an interesting mechanic that sort of encourages you not to, you know, like it's, I'm almost playing it like Yoshi's Island when I was a kid, where I just get through it and then I go back and get the 100% thing later. The way Wonderling, I think, encourages you to do that, we haven't said, is the collectibles, the coins of this world, which are little seeds, aren't just collectibles. They're sort of your life's blood.
Yes.
If you go too long without collecting one, you die, right? And you know, again, you don't go back very far. But it means that if you're going to go for the treasure, you sort of have to have the puzzle solved, have to have your route planned out ahead of time. You can't sort of futz around and eventually find your way there. So for me, it's been really, really, you know, like frustrating occasionally, but mostly really neat, because it means like, okay, I know how to get that treasure, I'll go back to it. But right now, I only have enough energy to get through the level, so I'm just going to focus on that. And then sometimes I go back right away, and sometimes I move on to the next level. It's like, it gives it this propulsive, interesting energy that I think you know, games don't, you know, this genre of game doesn't always achieve.
Yeah, that's it's funny that you say that. It's as you said, as I said before, it's like something that we actually spent a lot of time just thinking about and trying to design around, and I'm very glad that it worked out, because it was very important for us that it's playable by pretty much everyone. And in like, we didn't want to, initially, we actually didn't, to explain, like the flowers, the seeds, when you collect them, they turn into flowers the next time you try to play that level, because they are in themselves like a collectible that we track, and they unlock something when you have all of them. And to start with, we actually didn't want to have that. That was something we added due to external pressure, I would say. Because we were afraid that if we made it something that we tracked, that we would like force you to try to collect them all, and that would like ruin the experience, because that's something that we didn't want to put something in your way. We wanted everything to just like be tightly fit together, but it turned out very nicely, I think.
It does. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily feel good to, in games where you do feel like you sort of have to collect everything. I think of like the Bit Trip Runner games or something, right? If you've gotten through a relatively hard level, but you've missed one piece of gold in the case of Bit Trip Runner, or one seed or one flower in the case of Wonderling, your brain nagging at you that rather than seeing something new, you should just do that same level again better. Maybe that's what you want. Maybe it's not, right? So like the game giving you an out to think, you know, like, well, that was a sufficient accomplishment, or I know what I would need to do next time or something, so you can move on if that's what you would prefer, is a cool piece of design, I think.
Yeah, and I think one very important thing that we do in the game to facilitate that is that as soon as you pick up a flower, that flower is marked as collected. You don't need to finish the level to make it count.
Yeah.
So, because when you get the chest, you need to finish the level to like bank it. But that's like,
sometimes part of the challenge is figuring out how to get from the chest to the exit safely.
Exactly. That's been very fun to play around with, level design wise. It's been very fun to make levels for this game.
Yeah, the level design is very, very, like I said, rhythmic and inventive and playful. It's really, I've been enjoying it a great deal. I mean, again, like, I don't mean to keep comparing you to Rayman, but, like, those are, like, consummately designed platformers, you know, Origins and Legends recently. And the sort of micro-level level design reminds me of that. And so does sort of the world design. The fact that, you know, you're in a themed world, but it's never quite as simple as you think. There's always some sort of twist on the theme or some extra theme hidden in it or something that tells sort of a little oblique narrative about the space you're in. You know, it's really good at that too.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and I really don't mind being compared to the game being compared to Rayman. That's a good comparison.
I just meant I don't want to imply that it's like a ripoff or something, because it's totally not. It's very much doing its own thing. But yeah, no, it's good company to be in. Those games are great.
Yes, they are.
Were there other things that that influenced Wonderling, like, specifically? I know one of your co-developers mentioned Wind Up Night in the old Nintendo. Was it on the Wii U? I didn't actually play it, but I looked up some video. It has a similar thing where you're not in complete control of the character. Were there other games that sort of were on your mind when you were making Wonderling?
Yes. The most definite answer to that is a obscure NES game called Mr. Gimmick that was only released in Japan and Scandinavia. It's
interesting.
A beautiful, super well-designed, tiny platformer. And if you look at the screenshot of it, like, the main character looks a little bit like the Wunderling, and that's totally intentional. It's not at all like an autorunner or anything, but more like the design, I guess, sensibilities of short, well-designed, tight rooms connected together. I think that's a fun game to talk about, just because no one's ever heard of it outside of Europe, basically.
Yeah, totally. No, so why Japan and Scandinavia? Was it because of the developer that produced it, or that's an interesting story?
So I guess Japan, because it was developed there, and Scandinavia is because we have an interesting relationship with Nintendo here in Scandinavia. So we have a company that distributes Nintendo games called Bergsala, and I think they are the only third-party Nintendo distributor in the world. So they have a very special relationship with Nintendo. And I think the reason this game is available here is because, for some reason, someone at Bergsala really thought that, hey, this is a game that's gonna sell. Spoiler, it didn't sell at all. So they, I don't know if they spent the money to make it, to like translate it, or I don't know, but it's, I think someone's done like a deep dive into why this game got here.
That's interesting. I'll look into that and see if I can find some of the backstory. It's, looking at some screenshots, I definitely see the influence. Like you said, the little protagonist does look a bit like the Wonderling, maybe crossed with one of the dragons from Bubble Bobble or Puzzle Bobble.
Yeah, definitely.
It's also, like, looking at the screenshots, I don't know if was this a game from your childhood? Did you actually play it? But it looks a little bit like a Shameless Kirby ripoff in some ways.
Yeah, I get what you mean. I never played it when I was little. The first time I've heard of it, I was like, I guess, like 5 or 6 years ago or something. It's very obscure, as I said.
It looks very, very much like Kirby's Adventure in a bunch of ways, like the color palette and the way it's kind of, you know, pushing what the NES can do, and like actual character design, and even the little HUD at the bottom with your score, like, down to fonts and things.
You're right.
Placement. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I got to look more into this game. So you didn't play this as a kid, but you became aware of it later on.
Yes. So gameplay wise, I think otherwise for Wunderling, for me, it was definitely Super Meat Boy. That's a big influence in everything, both in what to do and also like knowing what I don't like about the game. Like, how can we do something different?
That's interesting. So what, I mean, not to in any way ask you to say bad things about Super Meat Boy or whatever, but I'm curious, like, what does that game do that you didn't want to do in Wonderling?
So one thing that people always praise Super Meat Boy for, I found, is the controls. And when playing the game, I think they're fine. They're really, like, it really works. but it's a very floaty game, I think. And it like the levels are all designed around it, and the game like totally works with it. But I never really liked that, and I think for Wunderling we really tried to go in a different direction. Like the so I don't know if you could call it floaty because like the game runs by itself, but the jump arc is you have complete control over your jump arc in Wunderling, and that was very much
Really,
intentional.
really, yeah, it's an extremely expressive jump. Like exactly how long you hold the button makes a massive difference.
Yes, like technically, as soon as you let go of the button, we cancel all your upward momentum and let you fall down. So you can do like, if you hold the button for one frame, I think you'll do like a 2 or 3 frame jump or something.
Oh, wow.
Which is funny, like watching like little kids who I can tell have played a bunch of platformers, and they just keep on spamming the jump button and expect to make it across the first gap, and they never do it because you need to hold down the button in order to jump high.
Sure.
Yeah, it's been
Yeah, interesting.
fun to design around.
To go back to the level design for a moment, the other thing I kept thinking about was Braid. Not that the two games are very much alike, they're not, but they share some common DNA in two important senses, I think. Number one, they both take place in sort of Nightmare Mario worlds, right?
Yes.
But then secondly, Jonathan Blow back in the day, and throughout the development of Braid and The Witness, talked a lot about how the kinds of games he likes are games that take a core concept and explore every facet of them, right? And Wunderling is very much about that. Like the different worlds introduce, one or two or three new movement mechanics, and then just do all kinds of wild inventive stuff with that. There's a lot of okay, but what if in the level design. This is a minor mechanical spoiler, I suppose, but there are these little sort of ambergris drip things that sort of like capture you and fall, and then you can decide when to break out of them, but when you do, you'll be at a full run, And it's
Yes.
kind of like really, really surreal, but it does immediately make sense as soon as you've done one or two, and the game is then very playful about like, okay, well, how can we, if we've made you waste your run breaking out of it, how will the rest of the room then be more difficult. If you can control when you stop falling, how do we make that an interesting choice? It's definitely like there's a lot of thoughtfulness in what is at first glance kind of a simple notion. You do a lot, you it does a lot with a little, I suppose is what I'm saying.
Yes. Thank you. And yeah, that was definitely. So the official name for that one is actually official. We call it the Honey Blob. Really,
That's a good name.
drips and drops like honey. But yes, that was very, very much something we spent a lot of time on. Like, I think that's another game that I take a lot of influence from is all the Mario games basically, but especially like the new Super Mario games and Super Mario 3D Land and 3D World. Very much like how they, like, because I think most Mario games are expertly designed in how they introduce a concept, force you to learn it, and they play around with it.
It's like introduce, escalate, twist, and then there's usually sort of a like a denouement, like a victory lap,
Yes,
using that same mechanic.
exactly. And then just basically, I guess, putting it in the bin and occasionally picking it up and playing around with it again later on, but usually being like, okay, we're done with this now. And I think developing a game with a smaller budget, we gotta make do with what we have. So
Right,
I think we mix more with it later on, but
We can't all be Mario Brothers 3 and just use the damn shoe in one level and then never again. Like that's
exactly.
there's something beautiful and extravagant about that. I mean, like I'm all about putting content in their content. I hate the word content. I don't hate the word content. I'm ambivalent about it,
I
but stuff. Let's just
totally
say
agree with
stuff in
you.
the game. Well, it's like there's. We'll come back to that in a second. But I was just gonna say, because that's an interesting topic, I think. But I was just gonna say, there's something really beautiful about stumbling on something like the shoe in Super Mario Brothers 3 and thinking, oh my God, this is such a deep, incredible, elaborate, exorbitant secret that's just for me. But it's objectively not a very scalable way to make games if you're on any kind of budget, right? Like reusing stuff, like that exploring every corner of the possibilities that you've set out is just good design and it's interesting for the player, but it's also smart from the perspective of not blowing your scope completely up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay, let's talk about the word content. I sort of see both sides, right? On the one hand, I like that it flattens everything. In other words, that, you know, something someone made in Twine in 2 hours is content, and something Disney spent $1 billion on is content, right? They're both just content. And if you like them, you like them. And if you don't, you don't. And if you get something out of them, great. But it's a very dry word, you know, like that's what I react against, is that like art is potentially too flowery a word, but content is like the other extreme, the other problem. It just sounds like it's dripped out of a giant funnel onto a conveyor belt or something, you know, and like,
it like totally drains all the soul of everything, I think.
Yeah. Do you have a preferred word? I mean, like game does fine, I suppose. But like, I use the word art pretty casually, because like I was an art history major in college, and I have no problem using a very broad definition of art. But I think to a lot of people, when you say art, they think of it as having to be good or highbrow or something, which a lot of games aren't and are better for not being, you know. So like,
I don't think I have a better word. That's part of why it's so like annoying, because I don't like the word, but I don't know what else to replace it with. Because I totally get it, and I haven't thought about it in the way you described it. Sort of like democratizing, it's flattening everything. That's a powerful thing. I think that's a good thing, but when it's used like, oh, this game, like. I think especially like with YouTubers and stuff like that, like, oh, we have a lot of content for you. Oh, I love to, like, the channel has lots of produced content for you. And it all sounds so, like, are you making videos? Are you making something that's you want people to watch, or are you just making content? Like, making content sounds to me like manufacturing something.
Yeah, as a unit of measure. So like in the case of YouTubers, I know a very common complaint among YouTubers is if they make like a really like a documentary, basically, right? Like a film, like a feature length thing that takes time and effort and has an aesthetic to it. And they, you know, they watched Orson Welles F for Fake 3 times and copied all of its editing tricks and whatever. That might get fewer views than just them talking into a camera for 45 minutes with no script and no effort and whatever. And that can be very frustrating because both are content, right? Similarly in games, you know, sometimes on the back of the box or the Steam page or whatever, people want to see how much content is in there. And it makes sense to a certain degree. They want to see how much bang they're getting for their buck or whatever. But the number of levels is ultimately way less interesting than how the levels are designed, right? So like the idea, like content again is a unit of measure, as like how much stuff, how many minutes or hours of my life will this eat, is such a weird, cynical way to think about things that at the end of the day you should be getting something out of entertainment, meaning, whatever.
Exactly. Like you, I think this is an analog that's been said a bunch of times, but like when you pay to go watch a movie, you're fine with it being like from one hour and a half to 3 hours long. But suddenly when it's a game, you expect it to be like, because every big game now is like 80 hours long, you expect all games to be like 20 hours long. And I think that like doesn't leave room for, I think a game can be amazing even if it's just 15 minutes long. I think some of my most, like, I haven't played a game like that in a long time, but I remember some old Flash games that you finish in like 20 minutes, and it's still left an impression on me today.
There's a game I think about right away in that context called Nano Pesos. I can't remember the developer's name. I'll put it in the notes. But just about like living on an extremely tight budget. And the whole thing takes, like you were saying, maybe 15 minutes. But it's like it really hits you emotionally. And just like all that, you know, you have to decide whether to go to the doctor or buy food. And like, you know, just like things that are very real for people, especially right now. But it expresses everything it needs to express. It's kind of cool to look at. It just has like sort of like idle animation, pixel art. The writing's really good. You're done. You know, those experiences, I treasure those experiences so much, both because I love, like we were saying with Wonderling, the idea of limitation. What can you do with a smaller amount of space? And also because we're all busy, you know, like even if you have all the time in the world to entertain yourselves, entertain yourself, I should say. There's so much stuff with which to entertain yourself. Like you could just spend the rest of your life entertaining yourself and not run out of content. Sorry to use that word. Like, so there's something about smaller experiences that I value, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Yoko Taro, who made the Nier games and the Drakengard games, talked a bit about how like game technology getting better should mean that a game can be anything, should increase the expressive possibilities, but actually in a certain sense has limited us. You know, like if you're making a AAA game, it has to be at least 20 hours long, like you're saying, probably much longer than that. You probably have to have combat in it, right? Like we actually end up with this very narrow, rigid set of rules about what certainly specific genres are allowed to be.
Yeah.
And it's weird. It's weirdly limiting.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Wonderling, I think, plays with that pretty directly, right? Because like it plays with all the conventions of what a Mario-style platformer is, and sort of, you know, it makes them silly and weird and grotesque, but also says, well, no, this game looks like one of those, but it's actually something a bit different, you know?
Yes, and I think it's been very fun too. A very rewarding development process, actually. I think that's like the bonus of having figuring out such a distinct, like, theme from the beginning, is that things just fall into place naturally for some reason. It's like it makes the design so much easier when you turns out that it's like there's always a natural solution for it. That's, I don't know how to describe it, but it's been a fun, lucky process, I think.
Interesting. Yeah, so the last episode of this show, I talked to Arvi Theakari, who made Baba Is You. And he talked a fair bit about how he stumbled onto a really juicy concept. You know, the idea of, I don't know if you've played Baba Is You, but it's like a block pushing game where the rules of the world are blocks.
Yeah, I haven't played it, but it looks really, really cool.
Yeah, so like in his head, he just like got struck by lightning and basically lucked into a concept that A, kept him engaged in the development process, and B, just had all these possibilities, right? So he wasn't struggling to find interesting things to do with it. He was just sort of, you know, exploring every corner that it led him to. Mm. Is that kind of what you're talking about? Like you feel like you ended up with a juicy core concept that you were then able to iterate on? Or do you mean something like even more abstract in terms of like what was compelling about the idea of Wonderling?
No, exactly like that. We nailed the I think we nailed the platforming and like the how the game played in the first like 2 months, and then we've added just like quality of life stuff, but everything past that has been iterating on what can we do with this concept, how can we play around with it, and there's like the game has, I'm here with content numbers now, but the game has like 109 levels, and I think we scrapped over 200 levels in addition to those, because it takes a lot of time to figure out. Even though you find like, oh, this should work, you think about something, you dream about something, and you figure out like, oh, this sounds like a fine idea, this should totally work in this context, and then you try it out and it totally doesn't work. But then you figure out that, oh, I just need to tweak this little thing about it. I just need to add, like, remove this thing or add this limitation, and suddenly it's fun. There's a lot of those little moments.
So you end up scrapping sort of the developmental steps, the stuff that was leading you to the stuff that's really interesting.
Yes, exactly. I think, yeah, we've been able to spend, like, 2.5 years just iterating on, well, the content, basically.
Yeah, I feel like in most contexts, the word stuff covers what content covers pretty well. You know, like, it doesn't need to be any fancier than that. But yeah, I mean, it occurs to me the other way that it feels a bit like Super Meat Boy, it Wonderling, is just the idea of, like, part of what made Super Meat Boy incredible at the time was it was made, you know, by 2-3 people. And it just had bajillions of levels, right? Like the amount of stuff, of content it threw at you was crazy, you know? I think Wonderling is sort of the heir to that in a certain sense, where, you know, if you're interested in this, there are so many variations on what you're currently enjoying for you to enjoy before you put the game down, you know?
Yeah, I would say so.
That's a hard thing to do, right? Because like the theming of the worlds is pretty thorough, besides there being different tile sets and looks and feels. We haven't talked at all about the music, but it's all sort of theme and variation in the way the game itself is theme and variation. There's sort of a main theme to the game that will da-da-da-da-da-da. And there are really cool versions of it in each world. This kind of like badass North African horn thing in the desert level, and kind of like a smoky version of it when you're in caves. Like it's really cool. But it means that, you know, to let the player move on that quickly means they can breeze past what, you know, stuff that must have taken a fair bit of work.
Yes. That's very interesting with the music, actually. Because when I So the music is made by a guy called Oscar Rydelius. He goes by the handle Rat Vader, and he works with like sound design and like basically everything audio related, and he did all the audio in the game as well. So I think he pretty early. So he actually has he was a part of another podcast, a Swedish podcast, where he talked about the game music and how he produced it. So I think he said something about like the leitmotif, like the theme of the game, came on very early, and then just like the game, you just iterate on that and try to match the, like we had already decided, like what kind of world themes we should have, like very classic platformer themes. But I think that's a good core concept, like ice cave, desert. Lava cave, stuff like that. And he was able to do something fun with that motif for every single theme. And he even used, I think for the desert theme, he even has an actual recording he did in India of like some street artist.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really cool. So what I was trying to get to, like, when I was developing the game, because I'm the programmer of the game, I really liked the music, and I remember like listening to it on my way home from work, and just spending a lot of time on it. And something I expected was that people would be more engaged with the music, but what we find is that, like, I think the music does its job wonderfully because it's never in the way. But I think that also makes it so you don't really think about the music, but it's, if you didn't have it, you would miss it. But people don't, I don't think people remember the music as much as I expected them to, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely.
I don't know where I'm going with this, but yeah.
No, I know what you mean, Because it almost does blend in, because it is that one theme, and then just a bunch of variations on it, so it can, like, it so completely makes you feel like you're playing the same game, but just in a different zone, which is exactly what it should be doing, that it's easy for it to be almost subliminal, you know? Like, I'm attuned to it, because I like game music a whole lot. But if you're just playing the game, it'd be a damn shame to play with the sound off. But even if you're playing it with the sound on, the sound might sort of hit you on a gut level. It's one of those things where I really do think what people will tell you was, you know, made the game good for them is not... Like what they may not notice what's making it good for them, I suppose, is what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
There's usually stuff, you know, often to do with game feel, you know, controls, like things like that, that are absolutely influencing someone's experience, but that your average player wouldn't know how to describe or might not even be consciously noticing. I think the music in Wonderling probably hits people on that level.
And I think that's why I was initially confused about that, because I've spent a lot of time implementing all those game feel stuff, so I know them very intimately. And I think I have the same relation with the music. Like, I know it very intimately. I've heard all the variations of it, and I care a lot about it.
I was going to say, with some composer I've had on, I can't think who it was, who said that game feel and music are very, very similar, in that people mostly notice them consciously when they're bad, and when they're good, they just sort of soak into the background. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's good. That's good to...
Yeah, maybe that's not true about music, but like sound design, right? People only notice sound design when it's not working. When it is working, it just feels like the most natural thing in the world. Game feel is a bit like that. Unless you're a complete nerd and you're thinking about sticky friction and whatever, it's not something most people think about while they're playing.
No, you're right. When I play games now, I'm broken down. I gotta figure out, like, how do they do. How does the physics work? When does it break? What edge cases do they support? All that stuff.
Of course. No, it's your bread and butter.
Just enjoy a game now. I need to break it down and figure it out.
Yeah, my wife's a performer and a musician, and she's the same way with music. You know what I mean? She's always breaking it down on that level. But no, I mean, like, and I say this totally supportively and lovingly, your nerdery about movement comes through in this game, right? Because, like, you don't realize how many nuances there are, especially because it is an auto runner, until you start messing with that very expressive jump, until the levels force you to deal with that very expressive jump. It's really, really cool how much thought has clearly gone into how this dumb little Goomba guy moves. Like, it's very lovingly crafted.
Thank you. And I think that's something that's very hard to convey in, like, a GIF or a video or something. You need to play it to feel it.
Especially with this auto-runner thing, it's hard to even, like, you can watch someone play Super Meat Boy and sort of see how expressive the movement is, but because the sort of left-right movement in Wonderling is constant, it's really hard to understand how expressive it feels till you pick it up, I think.
Yes, definitely. Oh, I have so many things to tell you about all the game feel things we added to the game. It's a lot of stuff to make you succeed, even though you shouldn't have. It's...
Oh man, I mean, I don't know what to say besides go for it. What stuff about like sticking to platforms or like a, what's sometimes called coyote time, where
yes,
if you're already off the platform.
Coyote time was one of the first things that we added. It's very.
Could you really quickly for anybody who doesn't know, just describe what coyote time is?
Yes, so it's called coyote time because it's basically it's when you have a grace period after you walk off a ledge where you can still jump. Like the game treats your jump like as if you are on the ground still. So it's called Coyote Time because of the old Looney Tunes, like Roadrunner cartoons.
Yeah, exactly. So that was one of the first things you put in this.
Yes. And that makes a huge difference. Another thing is, so we call it, like it's called input buffering. So basically, if you hold down the jump button, you will jump as soon as you land, which I guess you don't really think about, but if it's not implemented, the jumping feels like it doesn't respond because you think you, like if you press jump 2 frames too soon, you don't jump even though you should have. So that's the second thing we added. It's like as soon as you start falling, you can just hold down the jump button and you'll jump as soon as you land. And then we have edge climbing. So if you land on, like if you almost make it up a jump and land on the edge of a block, there's actually like the edge blocks have a little piece cut out of them on the edge. So you just like slowly walk up, basically just like edge hanging, like wall grabbing, edge grabbing, or ledge grabbing, I think is the right word. But in the context of, well, you're not grabbing onto it, you're just like walking up it.
Right. It works the same as like a lovingly animated, like, you know, 3D character going and pulling himself up, but it's very kind of seamless and quick.
Yes. And then we have so those one-way platforms. So that's something that I think made a huge impact, which no one, I think, would ever notice. But actually, if you... they have like a grace period of their like 8 pixels or so underneath them, that if you almost make it up to them but not quite, we basically go, okay, you made it, and we nudge you up over the course of like 5 frames or something. You never notice it, you never see it, but it, before we added that, the game just felt slightly off for some reason. Yeah, it's tons of small stuff like that you never, I didn't know about before I started developing this game.
Yeah, I think these are the things that if someone really likes platformers but has never tried making one, they might not necessarily know is in there.
Right.
The movement code of Celeste is out there for people who want to see like how Coyote Time actually looks as an expression of numbers.
Oh, I love that. That's so good that they released that.
Yeah, it's so cool. It's so cool. But yeah, it's like one question. So as you're introducing this stuff, did you introduce glitches or weird behavior unexpectedly? Like I assume if you do too much coyote time, you essentially have a double jump you didn't intend or something, right? Like did you have to do a fair bit of trial and error to get these numbers correct? I ask because I know with Celeste they certainly did, and I assume it's a pretty common thing.
So that's something that surprised me during development, is that I pretty much, when I implemented stuff like this, I just tried out the value and we played around with it and decided like, oh yeah, this works. And then it stuck, and I keep like almost waking up in the middle of the night going like, oh shit, is this value too low, is this value too high, is this timer too lenient, but I think we just lucked out, because we didn't do a lot of like iterating on those numbers at all. Things just clicked for some reason. It's really
awesome.
Weird.
If it works, it works. I mean, this is something else I've said before on the show, but players experience your game intuitively. So it makes perfect sense that some of your decisions are going to be intuitive. You may not be able to intellectualize them or explain why they work. You just try them and they work.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm a firm believer that your instincts are sometimes smart, you know, and you should just go with it.
Definitely. Trust your guts.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Well, thank you again for being like super generous with your time. Thank you for this game. I've been enjoying the heck out of it. I'm probably going to go back and 100% a bunch of stuff because that's who I am. But it's a really, really good game. Recommended. And yeah, I would love to have you back sometime if you want to talk about something else or all of that.
I'd love to be back. As you probably can tell, I'm down to talk about anything for forever. So,
no, and thanks for getting into the nitty-gritty of the movement code a little bit. Again, that's something that I think everyone who plays, you know, a game with jumping has experienced, but most people don't have the terms for. So thank you for getting into the nuts and bolts. That's really awesome.
Yeah, no worries.
Well, thank you one more time. Have a really good day, man.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
And that's the show. Wonderling is out now on Steam and Switch. The rather good soundtrack, which you are of course hearing as we speak, is available all over the dang place. Links in the show notes. The Everybody's Talking at Once podcast is hosted and produced by me, Drew Messenger Michaels, with support aplenty from Francis Michelle Lopez and Lucio Valentino. Our logo is by Aaron Perry Zucker, using icons from the Noun Project. We have some very cool guests coming up, I dare say. Some folks you've heard of, some folks you maybe haven't. All worth talking to, hearing from, and seeing the work of. We're locking down episode order. I don't like to announce stuff until I'm sure I know what you're getting from whom when, but I'll announce it as soon as I can. If you'd like to hear those announcements a little early, you can, if you'd like, become a Patreon patronizer at patreon.com/etao. Those fine folks get the show itself a day early and also find out who's going to be on the show a little sooner than the general public. If you'd like to do a completionist run of this podcast, you don't have to pay a dime. You can find all of our back episodes in the podcast aggregator of your choice or at etaopod.com. Stay safe, take care of yourselves, take care of each other. See you next time, everybody.